Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. As always, this is your host, Megan Marie. So we're up to episode number 15 of the Crystal Habit podcast. And this time, the entire episode is dedicated to chatting with Tomb Raider lead writer, Rhianna Pratchett. I apologize in advance for the audio quality, as phone interviews are always a little bit tinny sounding. So without further ado, we'll jump right into the interview as it tops off at over 60 minutes. Enjoy. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. As promised, I am here with TR lead writer, Rhianna Pratchett, and I'm armed with pressing questions from you guys, the community. Thanks for being on the show. Does it feel good to get out and start talking about Tomb Raider after a long time?
Oh yeah, definitely. I've been raring to go for a long time now, so it's great to be able to get out there and talk about things and engage with the fans.
Yeah, and we have a wonderful, passionate group of fans, and getting to the heart of their questions, having people like you and Camilla on, I know is really exciting for them. So thank you for being here and for answering their questions. So I'm conscious of the time difference on this call, so we'll get started, and I figure the beginning is a great place to start. So how long have you been gaming, and are there any definitive games that have sort of shaped your childhood and made you realize you wanted to be a part of the gaming industry?
Well, I started gaming when I was about six. I started quite young. My dad was very into tech and electronics and computers. And so I remember him bringing home an amp. I think it was a ZX81. And he had a game called Mazogs on it. And it was a sort of 2D, I guess we call them dungeon crawlers now, but we had no such word back in those days. And it was sort of, 2D, little pixelated man in a pixelated maze with pixelated spiders after him. And he says he remembers that I was very frightened initially when I saw this game, but once I realized that you got a little pixelated sword to kill the pixelated spiders, I was like, I fell in love. And sort of at that moment, that's where it all started, I think. And I used to get my dad's hand-me-down machines, and I'd play games on those, Amstrads and sort of moving up to PCs. I was a PC gamer originally and sort of got into consoles a bit later. I particularly liked adventure games. I used to play adventure games with the little girl that lived next door, and we would do things like, we tried a lot of the Leisure Suit Larry games, probably when we were about 14, trying to guess the Are You 18 questions that they used to have at the start of Leisure Suit Larry games, which were usually about the American political process, which is probably quite a good way of doing it. And we also used to play Conquest of Camelot, Space Quest, King's Quest. We played a lot of adventure games together. And she always made me play any bit she deemed scary, which was sort of if a wolf appeared on screen, which was usually made up of about six pixels. But that was a lot of fun. I used to play games with my dad. I used to draw the maps for him, so he'd kind of drive and I'd navigate. And that was, lots of fun. So I remember playing games with people. It was a social experience for me. And certainly, first of all, got into adventure games and then got into strategy games a lot. My dad taught me to play chess, and I think that sort of carried through. So a big fan of things like the Command and Conquer games, Dune 2, even the original Dune game, which is sort of turn-based semi-RTS, adventure game, and then very into Diablo games. As I think I said on the Nerd Machine panel, I nearly lost a boyfriend to Diablo 2, my playing Diablo 2, not his, and in retrospect, I should have gone with Diablo and ditched the boyfriend, really. But Diablo made a big impression. The cutscenes in particular in Diablo made a big impression. They're usually ones that I talk about, ways of using a ways of using a cutscene well as a sort of reward mechanic. Spent hours slashing your way through demon hordes, and then you got this really lovely cutscene, and you got a chance to breathe. It was well written and put together, and I think that really captivated me at the time. And that was the first time I remember, really thinking about a game's story to any strongly agree, although I really enjoyed the story and things like Conquest of Camelot and Adventure Games, but this is the first time it actually seemed cinematic. And then I got into playing the Wing Commander games, and that was when we used to have Mark Hamill in them, and I kind of loved those as well. So I've had quite a varied gaming history, and so I've pretty much played everything aside from sports games.
Okay. So how did you then transition and get your start into the industry?
I studied journalism, and while I was in my last year at university, I managed to get a little bit of work for a women's magazine called Minx. And I started writing, I think, about comic book characters. And they knew I was into games, and they decided to cover games reviews, which was fairly unprecedented for a women's magazine at the time. Mm-hmm. And so they came to me, and so I started reviewing games for them, and it only lasted about 4 issues before they went through a redesign. It all became about lipstick and boys, but it was enough to get my foot in the door of the industry, and I started getting games sent through and getting more work. I worked for a magazine called PC Gear. I then got a job as editorial assistant and moving up to section editor on a magazine called PC Zone, and I stayed there for a couple of years, really at the coalface of games journalism. And I also wrote for The Guardian, and then I went freelance again and did all sorts of stuff for the Sunday Times and various other places. And around the time I went freelance, which was about 11 years ago now, I was asked if I would be a story editor for a hardcore role-playing game called Beyond Divinity. And it was a game that I had supported the previous game. It was a sequel that I supported the previous game whilst in the press. The developers remembered me, and they were just looking for a native English speaker who understood their games, and they came to me, and so it was very fortuitous. Mm-hmm. So I worked with them, and when I finished, I thought, hey, you know, there's work here. I didn't even think about games writing as a career, because it wasn't talked about that much then. People were obviously doing it, but it just wasn't really known about in the same way we kind of know more about programmers or designers or artists. Mm-hmm. And so I started hitting up the contacts that I made as a journalist and saying, hey, you know, I'm doing some kind of script writing now and character work. Do let me know if there's anything I can help you with. And, you know, a few of them came back to me and said, yeah, you know, absolutely. And I started getting little bits of work, anything from level dialogue to mission design, and then moving up to bigger projects like Heavenly Sword, like the Overlord series, Mirror's Edge, Viking, Risen, and, you know, now Tomb Raider. So I very much sort of grew my career step by step, which I think has really helped me gain a good perspective about all areas of narrative in games. And, you know, I've worked at every stage.
Yeah, absolutely. So as someone who's then worked on both sides of the industry, you know, I get this a lot also. Which side do you find more demanding or more rewarding? Are you happy working on this side of the industry in as opposed to being a critic?
Definitely. I think this side is both more demanding and more rewarding. I mean, that's usually the way it works, really. I don't think I could ever go back to being a games journalist again. Mainly because, weirdly, the pay is much worse than it was when I started out. It seems to have gone down. And, you know, I really enjoyed working in print media, and there's so few magazines around now, which is very sad. I really enjoyed my time there, and it was very important, and it gave me a really good skill set for looking at games and being able to break them down, and that's definitely helped me as a game writer. But I do enjoy this side of the industry. And although it's really weird reading reviews of games I work on, and I usually kind of just want to go and hibernate for like 2 weeks when reviews come out, and I don't kind of want to read them because I know what it's like being a journalist, and I know what it's like being a developer, and it's kind of like, yeah, that it all bubbles to the surface, and, you know, I'm sort of sitting there with my arms crossed going, oh, I can tell that they only played, you know, the first two levels or something like that. And I get sort of outraged about it. But, yeah, it's been a really interesting transition, but a really valuable one, I think.
And do you feel like your skills translated fairly well? Because as a games journalist, you're reporting factually, and then you have your editorialized pieces. But now you're creating fiction. Was that something that you felt kind of came naturally to you, or was it an adjustment?
It seemed to come quite naturally. I mean, I'd done a bit of that growing up, and wrote short stories and things like that. I don't think I sort of rebelled against being a writer, sort of during my teens. I think for semi-obvious reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
And I sort of leaned towards journalism because I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. Mm-hmm. And journalism is great for that because you get all, you know, you've got various opportunities. And I went through a whole phase of wanting to be an actress and a lawyer and a mermaid. sort of settled on journalist. And then sort of kind of got eased into the creative writing. And since then, you know, it's flourished a lot more. I do much more stuff outside of games as well. So I write comics and work on screenplays and TV shows and short stories and pretty much everything apart from novels, which I'm leaving to Pratchett Senior.
Yeah. So then, speaking specifically to Tomb Raider, what's your history with the Tomb Raider franchise? I know you've said you've been quoted as having sort of a love-hate relationship with the series and the characters. So do you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. My first ever industry event was actually a Tomb Raider 3 launch party. And my dad was known as a Tomb Raider fan at the time, and they'd invited him along, and I came along too. And that was my sort of first foray into the games industry, I think. And I played the first game, and that was, you know, I loved that one. I played a bit of the second. I can't remember whether I actually ended up playing any of the third. But after that, I was sort of aware of titles, and, you know, I played the odd demo, but I never really got into them again as strongly as I did at the start. I'm not entirely sure why that is. And I was a bit worried at first that maybe Crystal would see that as a disadvantage, but actually they saw that as a good thing because it meant I came to the franchise with fresh eyes and I wasn't necessarily beholden to everything that had come before, which was very much the attitude of the whole team on the project.
So when were you first approached to work on Tomb Raider then?
It was about 2.5 years ago, and I was already working for another Square Enix Eidos title. And so I was contacted through the internal mail system. And I'm not even sure whether I knew there was a Tomb Raider reboot in the works. I think maybe I did. I can't remember. But I did a test. I had an interview. I wrote some of the demo scenes, some of the early scenes with Lara and Ross, which I think have been shown now. And yeah, Crystal was very much looking for someone that could capture Lara's voice, and, you know, I seemed to be able to do something they liked, and so they went with me as their writer. But yeah, it seems a very long time ago. It feels like I've been working on this project for a very long time.
No doubt. So what were your initial thoughts then when you were approached about writing the franchise, considering it's such a, you know, beloved franchise and it was such a new direction?
I'm very much someone who embraces challenge and someone who will go towards the things that scare them a little bit. And yeah, I'm always looking for that next challenge and what I can help change and develop and really sort of put my stamp on. And I thought this is a great opportunity to go and to reboot, to revamp, revitalize, however you want to put it, a character that I'd sort of fallen out of love with. And it's like, here you go, now you get a chance to make her what you would have liked her to have been. And that's kind of like that, those opportunities rarely happen. And it was kind of like, yeah, definitely a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, I think.
So this is something that I know the fans actually would love a slightly a deeper explanation on. So as lead writer, which parts of the narrative are you specifically involved with? Because you work very closely with Noah Hughes, who's our creative director, and then John Stafford, who's our narrative designer. So can you kind of describe the relationship between the three of you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I largely handle the cinematic sequences in the game. So I work on the core storyline of the game and all the scenes that are mo-capped and a lot of the radio dialogues as well. Basically what we call the core narrative, which forms a lot of the heavy narrative lifting in the game. John, who I think has been on the project about a year, just between a year and a half, John is responsible for the level dialogue that happens during the game. I wrote a little bit of that to start with for our demos, and then John came on board and he really handled that. So he also does a lot of the AI dialogue as well and Lara's dialogue as she's progressing through the game. And we would all three of us would feedback on each other's work. So I would look at what John was doing, he would look at what I was doing. And we sort of formed a kind of narrative triangle, and we would discuss problems and if a scene needed to be changed, how we would do it. But largely it was me doing the writing, but with direction and feedback from Noah and John. And the same, it worked for the same way for the level dialogue for what John was responsible for. And John's also done a lot of the secondary narrative in the game and a lot of the letters and the documents that you find, which I know he had a lot of fun with.
So what other members of the team have you worked closely with? And like, what's the traditional collaboration method? Because obviously you're out in the UK, so do you usually communicate through email, conference calls? How often do you make it out to the studio and so on?
I've probably been out to the studio about 4 times now for various lengths of time. There was usually a lot of conference calls, lots of emails, messenger. I mean, technology has made the world a much smaller place, so it's far easier to be a contractor as long as there are these feedback loops in place. Mainly it was John and Noah I worked with. I worked with initially Tim Longo, who I think was the original experienced director. He was there at the start, and I worked with him. But mainly, yes, it's been Noah and then John. I've had a little bit to do with other members of the team, Ron and Brian and Daryl, and also Janos, who is the creative head of Eidos. He gave his feedback, and we talked about a lot of things during the course of the game.
So how do you start working on a project that's so large? Do you just dive in? Is there like a professional process or a motto that you follow, or is it just kind of like an organic evolution?
It really changes depending on the project and when you've been brought on board. There's never one answer when it comes to games writing, because your job can vary majorly depending on if you're brought on board a year into the development or 3 months before the end. Excuse me. So there's no one way of doing it. The situation is like having a box of narrative parts handed to you. It's a bit like being Dr. Frankenstein. So you get a box of parts, and this will include things like there may be a story arc, there may be some characters, there may be some visuals, there may be some themes. There may be lots of stuff in place. There may be not much stuff in place. You never know what you're going to find in the box. And I don't want to go with the Forrest Gump analogy. I prefer the narrative body parts. But it's like that. And you kind of, so they hand you over a box of body parts, and it's basically you have to examine what's there, what isn't, how you stitch it all up and make it into a living, breathing story again. It all depends what's in that box. And that can depend on a lot of factors. It can depend on how important narrative is in the game, how, for example, an action adventure game would have less narrative in it than, say, a hardcore role-playing game. But then an action adventure would probably have more narrative than, say, a strategy title. So, it really depends on the genre for the project, when you're brought on board, and the attitude of the team towards narrative, how important it is in the game.
I think that's really interesting, because I think some people have a perception that you just start from ground zero and they're like create a story. But there's a lot of puzzle pieces already in place, and then you're brought on to help make sure that that narrative, you know, it makes sense and that it's fleshed out properly and that it is very collaborative and iterative process. So that's very interesting to hear explained.
Yeah, it is very weird. There's no real blank page in games writing. You rarely start with a blank page. There's always something there. And, you know, it might get shaken up. It might get completely changed. But you're always working within the limits that are there, whether it's the limits of time or budget or gameplay or level mm-hmm. design. There are always limits that you have to learn to work with. And that can be, you know, a little bit disarming for writers, especially if they come from other mediums and they're used to being there at the start and creating everything and not necessarily working with this box of narrative body parts. Mm-hmm. So that it is, there is a real difference writing for games than other entertainment mediums.
So looking at that box of body parts, like, was there a specific aspect of the game that you found particularly difficult to flesh out? Was it like a certain scenario or a character or a string of dialogue? And then how did you overcome these obstacles without spoiling anything? Obviously, you may not be able to honestly answer that with what we've revealed so far.
I think it was actually trying to make sure that players, particularly the testers, understood what was going on, especially with our backstory and how that comes through in the game. And I think we spent quite a lot of time trying to sort of juggle how we told that backstory and revealed it to the players and sort of making sure that they were getting it along the way. And that's always a challenge. How much information do you give players, given that the nature of playing a game is so different to the nature of watching a film? You know, you don't know if a player has just sat down and is banging right through the game, or they are playing a little bit and going away for a week and coming back and they've forgotten everything, and you don't know if they're skipping cutscenes or whatever. So it is a real challenge to try and give the players enough information so they get it, but not too much so it feels like you're constantly repeating yourself. So that was the challenge, telling our backstory and getting players to understand that and that to be clear and Lara's motivations as well. And I think that's, you know, that took a lot because that's very iterative. You've got to sort of listen to player feedback and test their feedback and just keep iterating accordingly until it's all coming together. And one of the interesting things about games writing is it has such a large feedback loop. If you're, you know, working on level design, you can build something, drop it in the game and bang, it's there. You can see if it's working. If with games writing, you have to write it, then you have to cast it, then you have to record it, and then you have to drop it into a game, and then there might be animation. And so the loop from actually writing it to it being in the game and fully animated and fully voiced is a long time. And
Absolutely.
There's a lot of kind of steps in between, which can look kind of ugly and sound bad, but you have to kind of trust that they'll all fall into place eventually.
All right. So this is actually a pretty poignant question that I know a lot of people wonder. Some writers state that you need to be a woman to know a woman character, or so on in regards to other, you know, attributes of humanity. You've stated before that you tried to write Lara first as a strong human character and that her gender is sort of like a secondary consideration. So what is your reasoning behind this approach to writing Lara?
I just find it more interesting looking at the, you know, the things that make us human, the things that unite us regardless of gender. Mm-hmm. I think they in some ways can be more powerful. And also I think people, you know, people focus a lot on Lara's gender, people focus a lot on my gender, and, you know, sometimes I like to push that aside and just say, look at what is the human story here, because I think that's something everyone can relate to. And I don't want to feel that if I was telling a story about being female, I didn't want to feel that that might exclude certain players. So it's much better, I think, to look at the human story. I mean, Lara is a great female character, and also I've had the privilege of working on other strong female action characters as well, Faith from Mirror's Edge and Noriko and Kai from Heavenly Sword. So I've been sort of... I've done it a lot, but I always give my female characters as much dedication as I give my male characters. I mean, you have to, really.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was that human story I was really interested in.
And I do feel like that comes across. It's wonderful seeing people. I get to be on the show floors a lot and kind of on the ground level, seeing people playing the game. And I really do feel like we've achieved a level of people, you know, people identifying with Lara, which is such a great thing to see.
I was really hoping for that. So that's very exciting to hear.
It is. It's very exciting, and it is a very fresh take, I think. So similarly, being British, it must help you kind of infuse the correct level of cultural awareness into the character. So what ways did you bring out her sort of cultural identity in the character?
Well, there are some that have been lost to the rigors of games development. For example, she talks about Jaffa cakes at one point. That was rewritten for other reasons, I have to say. It wasn't an anti-Jaffa cake backlash or something, but Jaffa cakes are a very famous kind of half biscuit, half cake in the UK. And they're one of they really put the great in Great Britain Jaffa cakes. And they're always asked for by the Brits living in America. They always want me to bring Jaffa cakes over. Certainly in her language, she's kind of quite British without being too kind of colloquial and slangy. And, you know, I had to make sure that she didn't get overly British, which I think can be a problem. And, you know, I had to make sure that certainly check over John's level dialogue and make sure, you know, it was all falling under Lara's Britishness. I think when you're British, it's often hard to kind of break down what makes Britishness British, but you know how to write it, and it's not always easy to communicate to someone else. So you really have to look over things and say, okay, well, we don't say things that way, we say it this way around. And it's the same for American dialogue as well. I think British writers are a little more used to American dialogue because we get so many TV shows from America, whereas American writers are probably not quite as used to the way Brits speak. So being British certainly helped there. But, yeah, it's really hard to identify what makes her particularly British because I kind of think in British terms anyway. So it's probably easier for an American to say, oh, she's being very British there.
It's interesting because I have heard particularly that someone really appreciated your reference to climbing Snowdon. Like, that was one thing that
really helped
and really helped her feel grounded in that particular culture. So I thought that was a cool little comment to get.
There's been a couple of little references like that. Some of them have got lost, like Jaffa cakes, sadly. I've got little things in like that.
So I'm definitely interested in this perspective specifically from you. Lara has always been considered an extraordinary person. So what do you feel are her defining traits, both with like classic Lara and then now, and what do you think has been maintained through this transition that still makes Lara Croft Lara Croft?
I know that some people have felt that we're breaking down Lara in the game, that we're taking a strong character and just sort of breaking it down through the events that happen. But that's really not the case. What we're doing is taking her back to a time when, you know, she didn't have the answers to everything. She didn't have the guns and the gadgets to deal with every situation. She was seeing everything with fresh eyes, and she didn't know she was capable of doing it. And so she's on that mission of self-discovery. So all those traits that she strengthens throughout the game are in her, absolutely in her, but they've not been brought out in such a way yet. So that was really interesting from a writer's perspective to be able to do that. And we haven't really taken away from her. We've just wound her back, but everything is still there. It's still embryonic within her, and she's discovering it as well at the same time as players are. And I think that's delightful when you can get player and player character discovering everything for the first time. That's a real sweet spot, and that's been very important, particularly where her bravery comes from was something I wanted to look at. And the fact that we do see her being scared and you know, sobbing at certain points and turning to Ross for help, and seeming a little bit helpless, and, you know, not necessarily what you want to do with a strong female character, but that's the important part, is you see her grow. You see her actually just having to face up to things, and you know she's utterly scared, but she realizes that, you know what, she's going to have to get herself out of this. And it's that realization I think is powerful. And I think it was a little bit shocking to players to see Lara being scared, because you rarely see characters being scared, especially when they've got they're usually seen as so strong and capable. And I think that was a little bit of a shock for players. But I think we're playing the long game with Lara. So when you're seeing Lara sort of scared and asking for Ross for help, that's very early on in the game. And you see her basically having to pick herself up and like, okay, I have to do this one step at a time. And if I get knocked down, I'll get back up again. And it's that character evolution and discovering the things inside herself and discovering that the magic in the world, I'm talking sort of not necessarily supernatural magic, but just, you know, her love of tombs and her geekiness about archaeology, that comes out as well. So it's not all kind of doom and gloom that, you know, she gets, you know, excitable and almost burbly, and, you know, that kind of geeky archaeology student really comes out in certain places as well. And that was a lot of fun to do.
Yeah, and those are some of my personal favorite parts in the game. We've shown a little clip of it now, but when Lara discovers and sort of enters her first tomb, I think that was a real moment for me that registered as this being Lara Croft. Still, it very much resonated as a longtime fan. And so I totally agree with that. Seeing her sort of geekiness for archaeology come out is really rewarding.
Yeah, it's kind of like seeing Indy get his hat for the first time in Last Crusade.
Exactly. So I think I need to move on to some community questions. Otherwise, I could keep talking to you with all these general questions forever. So we'll move on to a couple of questions from the Eidos forums. So Adobe Artists asks, and this was such a, you dropped some tidbits about Lara's backstory in a recent interview, and the fans absolutely loved it. So Adobe Artists asks, I understand why there's no mansion and why Lara doesn't have access to state-of-the-art utilities while on the island, but going by what the article says, why does she choose not to tap into her inheritance? And does this mean that Lara has completely forsaken her aristocratic heritage in this reboot? We don't obviously want to go and explain everything and go into too much detail, but I know people are curious as to if Lara is still an aristocrat, if she's still posh.
Well, it's sort of, I think there are, the word aristocrat doesn't really exist as much in England as it used to, certainly not when Lara first came out, and I think people sort of mistake aristocrat with royalty and things like that, and it's not really used in that way anymore. So, for example, we wouldn't necessarily say that every lord is necessarily an aristocrat. I wouldn't say that Lord Alan Sugar considers himself an aristocrat. You know, my father is a knight, he is a sir. I don't think he considers himself an aristocrat.
Yeah.
So Lara definitely comes from money. Her father is titled. At the start of the game, her parents are missing. They've been missing for a number of years. That side of things is not touched in the game. Her parents don't appear. So she has technically access to that money, but she doesn't want to touch it for a number of reasons. One, she very much wants to stand on her own two feet. She's very... not exactly stubborn, but, you know, she wants to make her own way in the world on her own terms. So she puts herself through university. She works several jobs in order to do so, one of which she mentions in the game. She talks about a late shift at the Nine Bells. And she doesn't use her family's money to do that. She does it herself. And also, because her parents are missing, she kind of doesn't want to touch that money, because it's sort of tantamount to admitting to herself that they're really missing and, you know, they're not going to come back. And so, and we explore this a little bit more in the promotional comics, she actually ties up that wealth in trust and all kind of things, so she can't touch it even if she wanted to at this particular moment in the game. That's not to say she won't change her mind about it, but for where she is now, we didn't want that to be a factor, and I wanted her to feel about it differently. I wanted her to feel something that I think modern audiences would accept a little bit more than the sort of throwing money all over the place, you know, gadgets up the yin yang, fancy this, fancy that. I think that's hard to relate to and a little bit crass in this day and age. So, yeah, she might get there one day, but that this is how Lara feels at 21.
Very cool. So Adobe Artist has also another very interesting question, one that I thought resonate with you. So he says, here's one to ask an Egyptologist, because you did study a little bit of Egyptology, correct?
I did, yes.
So he says, the burial traditions of pharaohs was to have their most prized worldly possessions placed in the tomb with them so they'd have it there for them in the afterlife. So what possessions would you take with you that you just couldn't do without in your afterlife?
Oh, gosh. Well, probably some cats, but I'm thinking they're probably there already because, you know, if it's the Egyptian afterlife, then you probably can't mm-hmm. move for cats. Probably my laptop. Can you take an internet connection in the afterlife? Is there Wi-Fi in the afterlife? You know, that's a question that has never been answered.
I sure hope so.
Yeah, as a writer, something to write on would be great. And because I type so much, my handwriting is awful. So it'd have to be some kind of laptop would definitely be great. Earl Grey tea. I'm very British like that. Jaffa cakes would also be good.
I'm going to need to get some of these. I need to try them next time.
Yeah, they're great. I think you can get them in certain sort of British shops over there. But yeah, they're amazing. Yeah, if I see you before the end of this project, I'll bring you some Jaffa cakes.
Definitely. Awesome.
Yeah, Jaffa cakes, cats, internet connection, Wi-Fi. That would all be good. It's a hard one.
I think that covers it. That's funny because my first reaction was my cat also, and that's like, oh, that's kind of a mean thing to say. But again, I would assume.
Well, I wouldn't, you know, I'm hoping I'm going to outlive my cats. So they'll probably
exactly.
already be in little canopic jars.
So they
could kind of come with me. It would be nice to bring my boyfriend as well, but I'm not going to insist he kind of, you know, be sacrificed in a funeral pyre if I was to go before him. But, you know, if he's already gone again, then he could have his own jar. It's kind of some fish, tropical fish. Oh, I'm getting quite into this question now. I could probably come up with things for ages.
Funny. All right, so we have another question from the IDOS forums. Trans Trouble asks, I assume you watched some actors do the voice recordings of the characters in terms of motion capture. Did you have anything to say in terms of last-minute changes to the script when you noticed something wouldn't suit the actors? So essentially he's wondering, did the script change or any scenarios change to accommodate what the voice actors brought to the table? You know, specifically maybe with Camilla, did any of that change based on how she delivered performance?
Not that much. We always did sort of practice performances of the mo capture shoot. So it's more likely that things would change because maybe when an actor read it, it didn't sound quite as good as it did on paper, and so it needed a little bit of tweaks, or maybe it sounded a little awkward, and so that it would get tweaked because of that. But it was largely quite small stuff, so that the bigger tweaks came if there was something in the gameplay that was changed or the level design was changed.
Mm-hmm.
We always paid attention to the performances and we always gave feedback on that, and there would always be kind of little things that sort of came out through the direction of it. But there wasn't sort of too many changes. It was just little stuff here and there, and it was the sort of gameplay and the level design that really brought bigger changes in rather than the actors themselves.
Okay. So Dark Angel asks, will you also write the new Tomb Raider comics? So we can't talk too many details about this, but you did confirm a little bit about the comics.
Yeah, I believe there's actually been a press release about it now, so I'm allowed to officially say that. So I've written, I don't even know if I'm allowed to say how many, but I have written the promotional comics. And these take place prior to the Endurance Expedition. So they explore sort of what happened in the few weeks running up to it. And that was really, really enjoyable to do. Actually, I got to explore a lot of the characters' backstories. Mm-hmm. And I got to work a lot with the character Whitman, who is one of my favorite characters. And so that was a lot of fun to do. And I think it will really help players kind of understand the characters a little bit better and where they've come from and their sort of attitudes towards Lara and their relationship with her.
Right. So Dark Angel also asks, Ellen Ripley, Sarah Connor, or Lara? That's kind of an evil
question. Oh, that's really difficult because, you know, Lara's my baby now. And I don't know. I love them all for different reasons. I grew up on Alien and Terminator. And, mm-hmm. you know, I once went to a fancy dress party dressed as an amalgamation of Ripley from Aliens 1, 2, and 4. And so I had kind of like combat pants and a vest top and a you know, makeshift flamethrower and a small ginger toy cat on my shoulder and I think a US Sulaco hat and I sharpened and pointed my fingernails and painted them brown and had an 8 on my shoulder. So yeah, that, although lots of people thought I was meant to be Lara Croft.
It's but, amazing yeah, how often that, anytime somebody has a pistol or like holsters.
Yeah, it is true. That so it really started with Ripley. Yeah, it really started with Ripley for me. So that's when my first love is.
Okay. I think that's a fair answer.
It's very difficult to choose.
Absolutely. So, and then Shaikh asks, in Mirror's Edge, so he's a big fan of your Mirror's Edge work, by the way. He had about 4 questions related to your tying your work with Faith to sort of with Lara. So he says, Faith mm-hmm. has to save her sister, and Tomb Raider Lara Croft has to save Sam. Are there any other similarities you feel that these two characters have?
I mean, they both have a lot of history with each other. I'd say that Faith and Kate have a much more of a strained history together than Lara and Sam do. Lara and Sam, they both went to university together, so Lara studied archaeology at UCL and Sam studied cinematography there. And Sam is you know, as you'll see in the comics and also in the game as well, she comes from a very rich family as well, but unlike Lara, she really makes the most of it, and she's a much more of a socialite and party girl, and she really... But she really cares about Lara. She does admire Lara's integrity, and even though that's not how she chooses to live her life, she respects Lara for doing that. But Sam, at the same time, is very passionate about filming, and she's a documentarian, and so she has her geeky loves as well, and that, you know, that's a lot of fun. Again, that's sort of explored in the comics. So she's been through, you know, university with Lara, and she was always the one, you know, trying to get Lara away from her books and, you know, into mm-hmm. the pubs and clubs and stuff. And she sort of kept Lara, you know, actually having a social life as well mm-hmm. as kind of hitting the books. And so there's a strong friendship between them, and there's kind of, there's a lot of love between them. But with Faith and Kate, because they sort of start almost on opposite sides, and again, the comics, the Mirror's Edge comics, were used to explore why that relationship turned out the way it did. So I'd say definitely hit the promotional Tomb Raider comics if you want to find out more about Lara and Sam and Lara and all the other characters. There are a few similarities, but not that many between them.
Okay, so we have a couple of questions from Facebook, too. So Kyle Coopersmith asks, what non-Tomb Raider games would you say influence the story for this game? But you can open that larger, too, if what just general sorts of stories or narratives inspired you when writing this new version of
War. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I remembered when I came on board was the movie The Descent was a big mm-hmm. influence for Crystal. I thought that was great. It's like there's a big American developer who was referencing a fairly small indie cult movie. And you know, I thought that was great. And I'm a big fan of Neil Marshall's work. I'm a big fan of Descent in particular. So that was definitely one. I know Lost was an influence to a degree. So I'd say those two in particular, especially for some of the visuals for Lara.
We have another Facebook question from Isaac Cabrera, and this one's a bit of a complex one. So he says, how difficult is it to write a strong narrative for such an iconic character who in the past is known for controversy due to the complexity of female empowerment while also being a sex icon? And while trying to keep the balance between that, how do you keep the balance between what you personally want to put into the character? And was there a time you had to cut any sort of lines or story direction because you felt that it went one way or the other too far?
No, I don't think so. I think both Crystal and myself had quite a good idea of what we wanted to do with Lara, and we really gelled with how we wanted to develop her character along the way. And because I worked so closely with Noah and John, we really knew what each other were thinking about, where to go with her, and we were constantly feeding back. And we were quite sensitive to how we were portraying her. And of course, I spoke earlier about that there is a risk inherent with showing a character that has traditionally been very strong and capable in back in a time when she wasn't quite as strong and capable, or she was, she just didn't realize it yet. But as I said before, we're playing the long game with her, so that's very early on, and you'll see her develop and her access that strength within her, and fight on through the game. And I think that that was a very interesting thing to do. So it's always a balancing act, but you have to take choices as creatives, and you know that you're not going to satisfy or please everyone all the time, but you just have to make a choice and stick with that creative vision.
We have another question from Tumblr, and Violet Story asks, she says, "For Rihanna," who says, she says, "You're totally awesome, by the way. I just wanted to ask for any advice for writers wanting to break into video games." That's a big question.
Well, for a start, play video games. And I know that seems obvious, but it's amazing how many writers come up and ask me about writing for games and they've never played a game. Know the medium. That's one of the most important things. Play as many games as you can. Obviously, being a journalist, that meant I actually had to do it and was thankfully being paid to do it. But you really need to understand the medium. Read books on design as well. Look at how games are put together, and how writing can fit in to them. There are many more books out there about games writing. There are lots of great ones that the IGDA Writers Special Interest Group have actually put together that are all stories from the trenches about different aspects of game writing, about localization, about working on new IPs, about working with voice actors, that are all really good for getting an idea of what you'll be expected to do within games. Other than that, it's about networking. It's about going to industry events and conferences, about talking to people, about going to talks given by writers, and just meeting people and networking and finding out what people are looking for and putting together samples that you don't necessarily have. If you've got no experience, then make it up. Look at a game that you really like and craft a scene for it that wasn't actually in the game, but you can imagine might have been. Look at kind of bark dialogue, do a cutscene sample, do a level design sample. And again, these books can be very good for sort of breaking down the different elements of narrative and allow you to get an idea of how they're put together. So you don't necessarily have to have experience and samples that have been published to put together good, relevant games industry samples. I mean, most game developers will require you to do some kind of written test as part of a kind of writer audition.
That's usually my first piece of advice when I get a lot of questions about specifically breaking into games journalism, and I just say, start writing. There's nothing stopping you from
Yeah,
starting your own blog,
absolutely.
from covering events, and other than networking, just starting to write and craft and hone your own voice is so important. So it's awesome to hear that reinforced. So we have a handful more questions. We got three more questions. These ones are from Twitter.
Okay.
So, Pokey Warrior asks, were there any characters in your original story that were cut, and did you miss seeing them go?
Without spoiling things, there were certain characters that have had certain things done to them during the game that weren't originally envisaged, I guess.
Yeah.
But I don't think any were cut from the original game. But there were certain things that changed with the characters through the development process.
Dima Inovich asks, is it hard to write a realistic story for a character that's formerly been a bit of a caricature?
Kind of yes and no. I think because we were coming to this game looking at kind of rebooting things and keeping what we liked about the character and building in new things or drawing out aspects of that character that we thought had been maybe lost or diluted over the years that we really wanted to focus on. It was almost, in some ways, like starting a new character, or at least it was that approach. But you always, when you're working with game characters, you're always working within limits anyway. It can be a limit of budget or gameplay mechanics or level design. And so working with limits of, you know, pre-existing backstory or bits and pieces along the way, it's just more limits to work within, and you kind of get used to doing that. So there wasn't definitely enough space to work, or Crystal gave me enough space to work with to create, make this character feel the same but different, I guess.
Okay. And the final question from the community is from Lara's Generation, and they ask, did you focus on keeping the storyline realistic? So I've interpreted that as, can you kind of speak to the balance of realistic and fantastical elements in the narrative? Because you obviously want to ground the character, but then to some degree, you know, she's perhaps tougher than a normal human, even though she has, you know, even though she is human. So, like, how do you balance the believability with the suspension of disbelief?
I think gamers always go into a game with a suspension of disbelief. So thankfully, that's sort of inherent in the way we play games. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think throughout the game, you know, Lara is actually sort of suffers, and you see the kind of cuts and bruises, and it's more realistic from that point of view. But sort of certainly going back to her, the way she reacts to things, particularly situations like the first kill, is much more kind of realistic and human. Mm-hmm. And we really wanted to show that her actions fed back into her character, because in all other entertainment mediums, action equals character. But so often in games, you kind of get this schizophrenic situation where a character is one thing in cutscenes and then goes on to perform mass genocide during the levels, and that never feeds back into their character. It's like it sort of never happened to their character. And we really wanted to bring that back into Lara and look at what does it mean to take a human life, and actually show her doing it and reacting badly to it, and, you know, dealing with that throughout the game as well. She is not comfortable having to do that. Mm-hmm. And she does wrestle with that throughout the game. And so the internal journey she goes through is every bit as challenging as the external journey she's going through.
Yeah, so it's you're grounding the character. Even though she's in these extraordinary situations, she's reacting in a very believable human way, which...
Yeah, I think that was very important for what we wanted to do with this reboot of Lara's character.
Great. So now we're going to end on one final question from me. So if you had to choose one takeaway for fans to have from this upcoming game, what would it be? So essentially, what do you hope resonates most with players about new Tomb Raider and new Lara?
I think it is about creating this more humanized, realistic Lara, and as well as sort of having her react in a human way to bad things, she also reacts in a human way to good things as well. She kind of gets overexcited and burbly and kind of a bit geeky about things, and she has that sort of that love of archaeology still definitely comes through. So it's about making her relatable, but still interesting and not dull. We're taking players on a journey with Lara, where we're taking them through the origins of her character and how that develops, and that's a very powerful experience. Or I hope it's going to be a very powerful experience. We've certainly been getting a lot of good feedback about it. So I think that's probably the takeaway.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing is that I have to keep reminding myself to talk about the gameplay and how the gameplay turns out to be incredibly fun and challenging. And you know, the game is an awesome experience, but I feel like Lara herself resonates above and beyond, and that's such an exciting thing to have such an extraordinary character at the center of our game. So thank you for fleshing her out with such respect.
I hope so. Yeah, I mean, and I think the gameplay... And Lara's character, she appears in cutscenes. There's a sort of synergy there. It feels like a whole character. She doesn't feel schizophrenic. She's the same character in gameplay as she is in the cutscenes. So, you know, the bravery and tenacity and resourcefulness she shows in gameplay, she also shows in cutscenes. And so that feeds into, the gameplay feeds into the story. I mean, gameplay equals action equals character. And so that's all... You know, we're using everything to tell the story, everything to reinforce her character.
Yes, and I, having recently played through the entire game again, I feel that was done very exceptionally. So I cannot wait for people to get that game on March 5. So I managed to get you for an entire hour. Thank you so much for chatting with us. I think that this podcast is going to go over extremely well. So thank you for taking the time to chat with us.
You're very welcome. I'm going to go and have a big cup of tea now and be terribly
all
British.
And that concludes our show for this month. I hope you guys enjoyed that added level of insight that Rihanna provided. We'll try to do more behind-the-scenes interviews in the coming months as we reveal even more talent working on the game. Till next time.